I'm Sherry Parks, in for Tom Hall, and this is Midday. Today, a conversation about police culture and how it may differ from the cultures of the people they often police. How do misunderstandings and contradictions create and perpetuate tension and mistrust between officers and Black communities? Edward Jackson is a former Baltimore police colonel who teaches criminal justice at Baltimore City Community College. Elise White is a principal research associate at the Center for Court Innovation, where her work focuses on youth incarceration. Rich Marin is a senior editor at Pew Research Center and co-author of their report, Behind the Badge. They join me for a conversation about culture and policing next on Midday. First, the news. Good afternoon and welcome to Midday. I'm Sherry Parks, filling in for Tom Hall, who's guest conducting in the Berkshires and Western Massachusetts. We have seen the videos from cell phones, surveillance, and police cameras in the moments before and sometimes after police shootings of Black people. It sounds like the police and the Black people are shouting from completely different social realities. Sometimes the Black men ask, "Why'd you shoot me?" or others ask, "Why'd you shoot him?" The shootings are the horrific tip of an iceberg. According to Gallup, 24% of Black men between the 18 and 34 report that they have been mistreated by the police in the last 30 days. Today on Midday, we dig into the cultural differences between the police culture and that of the Black public, and specifically young Black people. Edward Jackson joins me in the studio. He retired from the Baltimore City Police Department as a colonel in 2004. Now he teaches criminal justice at Baltimore City Community College, and he was recently appointed to Baltimore City's Community Oversight Task Force by Mayor Catherine Pugh. That task force was one of the mandates set by the consent decree with the Department of Justice. Rich Marin is a senior editor at the Pew Research Center. He co-authored a report, Behind the Badge, which surveyed nearly 8,000 police officers about their views on policing and fatal encounters between Blacks and police. He will be with us from his office in Washington, D.C. Elise White is a principal research associate at the Center for Court Innovation, where she focuses on justice issues related to youth, human trafficking, and alternatives to incarceration. She's also an adjunct assistant professor of public service at New York University. She joins us on the line from New York City. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Shay.
So, Rich, let's start with you and your report, because I think it gets at the differences between police culture and actually the general public as well as Black people. And we should also say that while you surveyed 8,000. You also did over 1,000 interviews, is an enormous number. And one of the things that I really was interested in is that the police saw themselves differently than the general public and specifically Black people in terms of enforcement versus protection. Can you talk about that?
Police generally view themselves as both protectors and enforcers of the law. The general public is a little more likely to see them as protectors, but this differs. The real differences are between Blacks and whites in the society as a whole, but also Black officers and white officers within the department. Not only are they different one from the other, but white police officers hold different views than whites in the general public, just as Black police officers hold different views than Blacks in the general public. You have a lot of divisions, a lot
okay.
of issues.
So let's unpack that. In terms of enforcers, 8% of the police saw themselves as enforcers only, 29% of the general public, and 39% of African Americans. So we're not talking about Black police versus white police at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk about the difference between an enforcer and a protector?
In police culture, and again, my knowledge is based on conversations with police leadership. There are several views of an officer's function. The old view was sort of the cop on the beat, kind of society's muscle, and that they were there to enforce the law. That was their job. Today, that view has changed, and most police leadership would like their officers to view themselves, at least to a significant degree, as protectors. They are offering a service, and they want to be seen as protectors. It's an image thing that people don't want to police don't want to be viewed as the enemy in their communities, but also it's rooted in reality. Much of police work involves protecting people, you know, intervening on behalf of victims. We're doing simple rescue operations. That part of police work is often underemphasized, but is a critical component of what police do on the job.
And I think this is important because what we're trying to do is to dig into the culture of different communities, and every culture sees themselves as good people. I mean, they have ideals and values that they're trying to uphold, whether we agree with them or not.
Oh, absolutely. And the same is true as police and the public at large.
Did your interviews give you any insight into that protector model, protecting whom, I think, arises?
No, these data don't speak to that question specifically.
And then you spoke a minute ago about the difference between black police and white police in terms of their protector versus enforcer. What is the difference there?
Well, it goes down to an even more fundamental question. How do black and white police officers view their communities? Specifically, how do they view the black communities, the black residents that they serve in their cities? What we found is fundamentally different views on the parts of white officers and black officers. 6 in 10 white officers characterize the police relations in their community as excellent or good, compared with only 32%. About half of black officers. This suggests a considerable gap in perceptions that I think feed a lot of related issues.
And you have another statistic, I think, that feeds into that, that the majority of police see death, the shootings, as isolated incidents, when the public is more likely to see it as an indication of a broader problem, and African-Americans specifically so.
Absolutely, and that's one of the critical findings of this report. Nearly 6 in 10 black officers, about 57%, describe these encounters as evidence of a broader problem between police and blacks. But only a quarter of white officers expressed a similar view.
And that gets back to the idea of culture, because that way, that if you see the shootings as isolated incidents, they don't disrupt the cultural interpretation because they're an outlier. If you see it as part of the larger culture, you see it as consistent to the culture. So Edward, you've talked about one of the quotes that really drew my attention to you, and we're going to go more into your story a bit later, but you talk about having two souls when you were on the beat.
Yes, and I was referencing W.B. Du Bois' Souls of Black Folk.
Yes.
I was required to read that in college. And
graduate of Coppin State University.
Certain people you had to read, the autobiography of Malcolm X, W.B. Du Bois, and the like. And I never understood it when I read it as an undergraduate, as a young man. But then as I grew in my profession, and in policing, And I was able to identify some of the sociological problems in policing. Then it made sense, the W.B. Du Bois statement, the souls of black folk. And basically what I was asserting in that quote was that as African-American officers, we have to have two souls. The history of the Baltimore police is a very, very interesting, fascinating one. It was controlled by the Irish ethnically for over 100 years. And when I joined 35 years ago, it was still Irish pretty much controlled. And so, like most organizations, brotherhoods, closed organizations like the military, you have to assimilate to the culture, regardless of where you came from. As a black man, a young black man, I had to assimilate. I grew up in the very streets of Baltimore that produced me. So a lot of the phenomenon that went on in the community, I lived it. And so when I became a police, that didn't change. I still had relatives, friends, family members, siblings that lived in the very communities that I policed. And there was a different expectation of me. I heard the researcher talk about protector versus enforcer. I think that in the black community, we expect black officers primarily, although it doesn't occur all the time, to be the protectors, meaning that we are there to solve problems, to keep the peace, the old watchman style method of policing, meaning that we are there to maintain the peace. And as long as the residents were satisfied, then that was evidence that we were doing our job. But it was different. You know, I came into the department 35 years ago where it was a very statistic-driven department. In other words, commanders and supervisors measured your value on how many arrests you made, how many cars you pulled over, how many people you interviewed. And that was pretty much the enforcer style. You were looking to find somebody in violation of the law, whether you saw it or not. And so I wrestled with that, you know, because I knew as a young African-American man growing up in Baltimore, I never wanted to be viewed as a sellout because I put the badge and the uniform on. I didn't want to be seen as the proverbial Uncle Tom that pushed my culture, my values, my ethnicity aside in the interest of rising through the ranks of the police department.
What does that mean on a day-to-day basis? I mean, how did you carry both indoctrinations, as it were?
Very difficult. I mean, really, I'll give you a quick example. Please. I mean, you walk in the beat and, you know, in the black community, a lot of white officers are not aware that a lot of times black men, we don't have country clubs. We don't have the facilities that a lot of the upper middle class white neighborhoods have. So the socialization process takes place on the street. You know, black men get together and tell stories. They sing. That's the part of socialization.
Mm-hmm. They talk. Yeah.
They talk. But then in the academy, they teach you that in certain areas of Baltimore, urban America, period, but Baltimore, we're talking about, that when you have a bunch of black men together, then eventually there's going to be some type of antisocial behavior or violence, a shooting, a stabbing, you know, a robbery. So police are systematically trained that when you see a bunch of black men on the corner, to immediately just disperse them. Well, you know, many African-American officers, I would submit, won't admit it, but they know the difference. But in the attempt to fit in and be viewed as competent and a part of the brotherhood, if you will, and I say brotherhood because that's what it was. Yes. 35 years ago. Yes. To fit in and to assimilate, you do what the dominant culture tells you to do, although you deep down inside, you know differently.
And what does that mean in terms of your behavior during the workday?
It's a fine line. I had said in the article, it's very frustrating because at times, especially when, and here's something that I still find very fascinating. You can arrive at the scene with, you could be the only African-American officer, for example, backing up, you know, three or four white officers, and you may observe them engage the individuals differently than you would engage them had you been by yourself. And so a lot of times you can readily see the culture clash. It has nothing to do with criminality. You can see the culture clash. And then the dilemma is, what do you do? Do you intervene? You know, you being the only African-American officer with three other white officers, do you educate them right at the scene? And so it's a whole complex culture, you know, because like a lot of professions, you don't call people out in public. So if an officer, for example, says something that's offensive or says something that's not culturally relevant, you don't, you know, admonish the officer in front of the very people that they stop. So you wrestle with that every day. And it's been a many day I went home and just very frustrated with the job.
So at the moment, the culture you have to pick is the police culture.
Yeah, exactly right. primarily you have to take on the police culture first. I mean, you're indoctrinated that way.
Okay. Well, let's take a break. And Edward Jackson is a retired Baltimore City Police Colonel who teaches criminal justice at Baltimore City Community College. Rich Marin is a senior editor at the Pew Research Center. Elise White is a principal research associate at the Center for Court Innovation. You can join us at 410-662-8780 or email midday@wypr.org. Back in a minute.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sherry Parks in for Tom Hall. We have a clip, and this is a clip from the Facebook Live video of Diamond Reynolds, recorded immediately following the fatal shooting of her boyfriend, Philando Castile, by Geronimo Yanez, a police officer in Minnesota. Let's listen to this.
He just shot his arm off. We got pulled over on Larpiner.
I told him not to reach for it. I told him to get his hand off it.
You told him to get his ID, sir, and his driver's license. Oh, my God, please don't tell me he's dead. Please don't tell me my boyfriend just went like that.
Keep your hands where they are, please.
Yes, I will, sir. I'll keep my hands where they are.
And in that moment, we hear the conflict that we're talking about, that we hear that the policeman had given contradictory information, that he said, keep your hands on the steering wheel, but give me your ID. And Diamond is, I mean, with a sense of presence that I don't think I would have in the moment, is speaking very calmly to the policeman, trying to explain to him that he's given contradictory information. We see the conflict right there, that any movement becomes dangerous. There are, what would you do in that moment, if I can put you on the spot, Edward?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think in all fairness, I think it depends on where you're at in your career, in all fairness, whether you're white or you're black. Early on in my career, right out of the academy, they teach you that everybody's a threat that approaches you, and at any time, a confrontation can go from very calm to volatile to even deadly in a matter of seconds. So cops are almost paranoid, if you will. They send you out there extremely paranoid. But then later on in my career, as I grew and matured as the police officer and as a man, my perception of fear was quite differently. So I think the answer to your question, the fairest way to answer it, is it depends on where you're at, you know.
So the point you're making is that the difference between you and maybe and we're making generalizations here, mm-hmm. between a white policeman is the difference in the perception of threat.
It's the perception of threat. That's exactly right. Okay. Because you have to understand, I know in the Baltimore police, when I was there, the demographic was interesting. When I first joined, all police were required to live, I think, within an 18-mile radius of the Battle Monument, which is right at Calvert and Fayette Street. I'm right in front of the courthouse. And you had to live any direction within 18 miles. So what that meant was that the Baltimore police were stakeholders. The men and women who served mm-hmm. primarily were stakeholders. They lived in the community. I found that most people, white and black, in the 70s and early 80s, were residents of Baltimore City. And so, you know, it came from different parts of the city. And, you know, Baltimore is definitely still is very segregated.
Yes.
But they did live in the city. And so they were more stakeholders. I find personally what's troubling now is that we import so many police officers who have no idea about Baltimore and the community they serve. So the only information they have are media portrayals of ethnic groups, you know, and particularly black men. Latin men, Latino men, are violent. And you're seeing it with the women now. You're seeing it more with women now.
And that speaks to something that Rich and let me reintroduce our guests for folks who may have just dialed in. Edward Jackson, who we just heard from, is a retired Baltimore City police colonel. Rich Morin is a senior editor at the Pew Research Center. And Elise White, who we'll hear from in just a second, is a principal research associate at the Center for Court Innovation. But Rich, you have a statistic about perceptions of equal rights that officers have a very different, particularly white officers, have a very different perception of whether or not African Americans have achieved equal rights at this point in history.
That, again, was one of the cornerstone findings of our study. What we found is that 92% of white officers say the country has made the changes needed to assure equal white rights for blacks. But that view is only shared by 29% of their black colleagues. Very different views of America, very different views of reality, as you described in your introduction, Sherry.
Well, and the police are different from other white people, too, because 57% of the white public that you surveyed said that versus 92% of white officers. So there's a continuum that's here. And if you think that people have achieved equal rights, you don't think about the larger cultural implications. I want to switch over to Elise, because she has done some very interesting cultural mapping. And truth in journalism, I have to say that I've known Elise for a while. Her PhD is from the University of Maryland, and I was on her dissertation committee. But Elise, I do want you to jump in here, because you've been simultaneously all these years and since working as a researcher for the New York court system. And your research, what really grabs me about your research is that often we say, particularly when we're talking about juveniles, they didn't make any sense. That didn't make any sense. And your research suggests that in their logic system, in that situation, it makes perfect sense. Sometimes it's very astute and brilliant. Can you talk about, having heard this conversation, how the logic system that you've been able to map out and document works and give us a story that would help us understand how within the system juveniles might be operating in a way that makes sense to them?
Sure. So I think one of the most important things to keep in mind when we're talking about young people is, and all the research that I've done, and I've interviewed hundreds of young people, the vast majority talk about feeling under siege. From the police, but also sort of along the whole continuum of criminal justice officers. So you're talking about court officers, correction officers, truancy officers, school safety agents, private security in stores. So they feel this constant state of surveillance. And, you know, time and time again, they articulate this feeling that the police are always there at the wrong time. So they're there to interrogate, they're there to catch them up when they're not doing anything wrong. But when they do need them, they're not around. They can't be relied on. Or they even, you know, will work contrary to this sort of enforcer narrative that we're hearing. So an example of this, you know, I've worked primarily with girls. But also, you know, some women and girls of trans experience, and then young men as well. But, you know, some examples would be, you know, a lot of these young people are involved in violent or threatening situations, both in their homes, with other young people in their communities, and when, you know, in particular, I think domestic violence and intimate partner violence situations, you know, one partner will call the police in to try to stop the that particular altercation, but then also sort of the pattern of that's happening in the relationship. And police will say things like, you know, well, what did you do? What did you do to make him mad? Or you know, for one young woman that I interviewed, a trans woman, she was having an altercation with her partner, her boyfriend, and the police picked him up and then drove him around the corner and dropped him off again because they just didn't believe that there could be domestic violence between a relationship of that nature. So, yeah, go ahead.
So one partner calls in the protector. But who arrives is the enforcer.
Correct. So this, I think And what I think is a hope, sort of a hopeful message, though, that I also hear is a belief that the protector, the role of the protector, the police's protector, is valid if it's done. They just don't feel that it's being done for them and in their benefit.
That gets back to the for whom question.
Exactly. Yeah, I thought that was actually a really prescient, an important question to ask. So I think for young people, you know, just within their, you know, what they talk about within their communities is that because there's this sort of presence or threat of violence from so many different sides, they're in a kind of difficult position of trying to figure out how to keep themselves safe and maintain individual safety, family safety, peer safety without a lot of the more sort of structural mechanisms that mainstream and particularly white America take for granted. And so a lot of their mechanisms that they're using, things like, you know, carrying weapons, having sort of vast social networks, I think as Edward was talking about, and that being something that happens on the street, these are perceived by the police, but also I think just sort of white America writ large, that as criminal or as dangerous and a threat. And so I see that time and time again in these interactions with the police for all of these African-American young people who are getting killed over the last 3 or 4 years, is this sort of like a minor or you know, not necessarily, it didn't have to be a life-threatening situation if kind of come at or understood with a different lens.
And African-American speech patterns are often more demonstrative than, mm-hmm. and that way may be perceived as threatening in a way.
Now, absolutely.
So I really want to dig into, because I know you can, into the logic system that often we may see either in the system or in the videos, an African-American juvenile or sometimes Latino juvenile who is speaking back, who is not completely submissive. That may seem to an outsider not to make sense, but if that juvenile is surrounded by other peers, why might that make sense? Take us through that logic system.
Sure. So, I mean, scholars have been documenting this for decades, really. But what we get into or what we see and what young people talk about is feeling, because there's this sense of pervasive threat, feeling that any sort of backing down or deference is going to be perceived as weakness. And so because these institutions are not trusted as safety providers or safe keepers, either for them or for the community at large, they don't see any other options but to escalate. And I think you see kind of a similar thing, to be honest, from the police. You've got both parties coming into scenarios feeling, and this is, again, I'm being very, very general, but feeling
threatened. But you've got some specific data to back it up.
Yeah, exactly. But seeing the other as a danger or a threat, being frightened, being sort of conditioned that they are in their life is at risk, and then mutually escalating the situation and being afraid to back down.
Because they also cannot appear, as you pointed out, to back down among their peers, because that increases
right.
the danger on the other side. So you also are working with the court system. The point of your research in the court system is to do what?
There are a variety of different studies that we do, but in general, I think the work that the organization that I work for tries to do is to help partners understand, is to sort of bridge the divide in a lot of ways, is to help help the courts and to help other legal stakeholders figure out ways to come up with alternatives that might more appropriately meet the needs of the folks that are being caught up in the criminal justice system.
So have there been changes in the way the court system works as a result of your and others' research?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think we're at a period nationally, and hopefully this will continue, but nationally, where people on both sides of the political aisle, and that, you know, trickles down into the institutions as well, are seeing, decades of research that shows that if you can match people's sort of general needs and risks with the correct kinds of treatment or social service supports or community connections, that you can much more effectively help deter future crime.
And has it changed any of the behavior of the justice system as a result?
Well, I think it trickles down to, I mean, it comes out in DA's charging practices. Yeah, I mean, in New York City, there are a lot of shifts around alternatives to incarceration, relying less on community service or jail for short-term stays. And helping to, again, as I said, try to connect people with meaningful alternatives.
And Edward, you're in the studio with me, and so I can see you nodding. Mm-hmm. And I think you were really responding to when Lisa and I were talking about whether the person who's interacting with the police submits completely or not, where a normal conversation can suddenly become a threat. Can you talk about why the police might need or want complete submission?
Well, I think it's a safety issue, but can I say this? I think in all fairness to all police, black and white, police officers, I think that what needs to be a larger part of the narrative in America, we often separate the police from the government. Mm. And I'll tie this back in, but we separate the police from the government. And, you know, the criminal justice system, whether you're talking about police, courts, and corrections, or all three, you know, cooperating together to achieve this notion of justice, is that there's six basic institutions of social control in America. And the first three are family, communities, and generally our faith-based institutions, because their role is to get us to subscribe to the dominant values of society. Those ethics, if you will, right? How to treat mm-hmm. people, how mm-hmm. to be respectful. And quite frankly, in many black neighborhoods, distressed neighborhoods, I should say, black neighborhoods, sometimes you can't separate the two. They automatically go hand in hand. Underserved communities, you know, absentee fathers, single parents, mothers who are struggling. It's an economic thing. And so a lot of times at the end of the day, all people have is their dignity. They don't have access to capital. They're not going to Yale or Harvard. So they don't have the same things to look forward to as many Americans. And so at the end of the day, that's all they have. So when they see police confrontation, you know, they feel like they're disenfranchised to begin with, that America doesn't appreciate them or really accept them. Then the police comes in. It's like adding insult to injury. And so when the police, they're frustrated. Many of them can't articulate their frustration, but they know that they're not living the American dream. So now the police are seen as oppressors, unfairly in many cases, because cops, I think a very frustrating for me part of the narrative is that we have expectations of police officers that they're ill-equipped to handle, whether you're white or mm-hmm. black. They don't control poverty. They don't control dysfunctional families. They don't control, educational institutions not preparing them to be a part of the mainstream. But then the end result of all of those things, it's going to be criminality. You know what I mean? You take away a person's ability to support their family, to obtain job skills, to read, and all those basic things that you need to survive and prosper in America. If you take those away, then you're going to have crime. Mm-hmm. And then we call the police in there to control it. So I think that my argument is that we have too much police, courts, and corrections, and not enough family, relevant faith-based institutions, and strong neighborhoods. And so we send the police in there to try to manage that so it doesn't metastasize into the mainstream, and therein lies the conflict. And I think both black and white officers get very frustrated, and the clash occurs mm-hmm. because the cops, they know deep down inside, many of them can't articulate what their role is. You know, they give them a badge, they give them a gun, they give them the authority to enforce, but they know they don't control these conditions. They're brought into it. And I don't care who you are. Cops not going to solve decades worth of problems in a couple of minutes. You know, you call 911 and go to a house for an intimate partner or domestic violence. That's been going on between them two for years. An officer's not going to come in 10 minutes and give each party the result, a fair result. It's not going to happen.
So, and I want to circle back to the dignity comment in a minute. You're listening to Midday. I'm Sherry Park, sitting in for Tom Hall. And we're talking about the cultural differences between the police and African-American culture with Edward Jackson, who teaches criminal justice at Baltimore City Community College, and Elise White, who's a principal research associate at the Center for Court Innovation, and Rich Morin, senior editor at the Pew Research Center. And after the break, we'll be joined by Lamontre Randall, co-founder of the community grassroots organization Be More Group and chair of the Baltimore City Police Department Youth Advisory Board. Back in a minute.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sherry Parks, sitting in for Tom Hall, and we are discussing the cultural differences between the police and African-American communities with Professor Edward Jackson, who retired from the Baltimore City Police Department and is now a teacher of criminal justice at the Baltimore City Community College. And we have Rich Morin, who's senior editor at the Pew Research Center, who co-authored the report Behind the Badge, which surveyed nearly 8,000 police officers and their views on policing and fatal encounters between blacks and police. Elise White is principal research associate at the Center for Court Innovation, and her work focuses on justice issues related to youth, sex work, and human trafficking, and alternatives to incarceration. She's also an adjunct assistant professor of public service at New York City University. And we are joined by Lamontre Randall, who is co-founder of a community grassroots organization, Be More Group, and is the chair of the Baltimore City Police Department Youth Advisory Board, and a founder, actually, of that group. And again, in truth, in journalism, I have to say that you and I have worked together
yeah.
on some projects. So you've been listening to all of this, and your work with the Youth Advisory Board was created because you felt that there was not a lot of community conversation between the police and the Baltimore community. I have to say that we actually did try to invite some members of the Baltimore police, but they were not able to be with us. So I'm really glad that you are here. Can you talk about these moments that we've been talking about? Particularly, Edward mentioned the need to preserve the dignity of young black people in their interactions with the police. And that's one of the things that they are most concerned with. Can you talk about why you felt you had to found a youth advisory board?
Yeah, so let me tell everybody backtrack a little bit. So the Youth Advisory Board came upon existence after the uprising, and the police department realized they did not have a youth voice. That's why we're here today, and that's why it was created. The reason why I jumped on board, I'm from Baltimore, 24 years old, and being within Baltimore, I got pulled over countless number of times as soon as I got my car. And a lot of officers never really gave me a real reason to why they pulled me over. With that constant harassment, it causes you to go through, a mental health despair that I think every black male goes through, especially within the inner city community. So with that being said, when I went to school, incident happened to me where police drew guns on me, and they didn't believe my situation. And from there, I was like, you know what? Look, I need to change the police department, and I need to make sure I face the situation up front instead of being scared. And what does that take? That takes heart, courage, and love, a lot of love, and a lot of forgiveness.
And actually, the Black Youth Project has a statistic that 2/3 of African-Americans have either been harassed by the police or know somebody who has been harassed by the police. That's their word, harassed. And so this becomes a cultural feeling.
Right.
And I know that one of the things that I often have done for years is when I see police with young black men, and I slow down and witness it so that they see that somebody saw this. And so you really are working at the conversation between the police and young black youth.
Yeah, I'm more of the gap bridger, in a sense. The community, I'm in a unique position because the community trusts me, and the police department trusts me. Brother right here will tell you that the police department, within their culture, they do not. It's hard for them to trust outside people too much. In order for you to get that trust, you really have to have a certain amount of ethics behind you, and you also take time to build that rapport. And same thing with the community. The community respects me and my work because I hold them accountable. The commissioner was just in a meeting with the mayor the other day and in front of a large crowd, and he told the mayor just how when they weren't being transparent with me about what was going on within the police department, how I had to lash out on them, and how that kind of changed their whole viewpoint on how they feel as though they need to be transparent within the community. So
so you're in that a very similar space that, that Edward was talking about, yes. That the black policeman is in terms of moving back and forth. But you don't have the backup of the brotherhood in a way. It's just you and your own cultural community currency.
Yeah, so I don't have the backup of the brotherhood, the fraternal order of police, you're talking about, FOP. But I do have the back of the community. And I do have the back of those who are the upper echelon within the police department, which is tough to have. It's really tough to get the ears of a commissioner, of a chief, of a sergeant. So,
how many people occupy that space? I mean, is it you and the advisory group? And how would one expand that to a larger group of people? Is that possible?
So it's a lot of different, what can I say, barriers to it. People who operate that space within the young people, it's not too many. Really, and I have one initiative that I'm pushing now called Millennials on the Ground. We're actually having young people out there really bettering the police engagement, helping with when it comes to transparency, grading officers within the community, because what we realize, and being mediators on the scene, because what we realize is a lot of millennials, and we did a study, and it's about to get released. The board did a study, and we saw when we were surveying the young people who are 25 and under within the Baltimore community, we saw that it's a lot of distrust, and it's just generational distrust. They don't trust the officer because of what their father went through or what their brother went through. And with that, in turn, a lot of millennials are scared to get involved. They want to get involved. They talk about it on social media, but when they're really taking that on the ground approach, it's tough. And it's because I think we're really facing a certain level of trauma.
And actually, it's interesting because Edward started talking about the Two Souls with the WD being Du Bois Two Souls, and of course, one according to Du Bois wants to get to merged consciousness. And at least having heard Edward and Lamontre talk. And you're talking about these two logic systems. Do you see a road to large-scale merging of consciousness? I mean, and what might that look like?
Well, I think that what Lamar said about trauma is really certainly what I see. And I see it actually on both sides of kind of the divide. I think I don't know if we can get folks to be able to acknowledge that trauma, but without kind of recognizing, having everybody recognize that this is something that is present, recognizing how trauma reaction is driving a lot of the sort of in the moment heated exchanges that are resulting in tragedy, I think that's really the first step. And I think that that's essential to getting a conversation going. And that's why I think, groups like Lamar's, where young people are able to come face-to-face with police in what feel like safe environments, are so important.
And Rich, I mean, you're working with a huge data set, but, you know, I know lots of people who do, and they often come away with hunches. Is it fair to ask you in your gut how you would answer that same question about the immersion? If it's not fair, you don't have to answer.
You know, it's not fair to ask me, but it's fair enough to ask the data about. I'll tell you one striking set of findings goes to is related to all of the excellent conversations that we've had in the past 50 minutes. There is a racial difference in the force and how, you know, being a police officer affects the emotional well-being of individuals. And the racial differences are striking. White officers are nearly twice as likely as black officers to say they become more callous since joining the police force. And those aren't small percentages. 62% of white officers say they become more callous compared to 32% of blacks. And white officers are significantly more likely to, they say, they always or nearly always feel frustrated about their work. Those are troublesome findings, and I think it goes to a sense of disconnect in the way these black and white officers view the community and ultimately how they relate to it. But they also is very different, based on very different experiences on the street. And I have to I wonder, after Edward's comments, about whether there's, you know, different words, different approaches explain some of our findings. 70% of white officers say they were verbally abused by citizens in the past month, compared to only about 50% of black officers. And 36% of white officers said they fought or physically struggled with a suspect in the past month, compared to only 20% of black officers. I'm wondering how much of those differences, and I don't have the answer, are due to different styles of communication, different life experiences, and different approaches.
And it sounds like there's a critical core of people who know that with the black officers. Edward, can you respond to that? Do you think it would be fair to pull out black officers and say, teach the rest of the force how to do this?
I think it would be fair, given the demographic, you know, because I think one of the things that needs to be said is that it's a lot about class, too. I find it fascinating. If I go to certain parts of the city where you have a middle class black constituency, college-educated professional African-Americans, college professors, lawyers, teachers, they have almost the same expectations of police as whites do. They see them as civil servants. They see them totally different. But again, we separate policing from the government. We separate policing from other social problems. When the police has to come in and occupy a territory, because that's what we're talking about. When we talk about the enforcer model, the legalistic model, what you're doing is occupying the territory. The government has neglected these communities, and so the behaviors are a manifestation of a whole lot of other social neglect, you know, because it's not only criminal justice, there's economic justice, there's social justice, and there's all forms of justice that we don't talk about in the narrative. And so at the end result is that you got this frustrated populace, and when they see the police come in, they don't see them as servants, they see them as occupiers.
Okay, and I'm going to give Lamontre the last word quickly.
Yeah, I agree with you a little bit, but I don't think it would be fair for us to for black officers to really go and engage and work on communication with the officers. And I think simply because of the brotherhood structure that is within the police department, a lot of officers who I've been on the ground with, and I saw them. So one scene we went to a scene, and what I really think is because of that structure of the FOP. And them feeling like a bond, a black officer wouldn't feel comfortable because they will need that white officer when it comes to that dangerous situation.
And I'm going to have to stop there. Thank you all. I'm Sherry Parks. We've been talking to Edward Jackson, retired from the Baltimore City Police, Lamontre Rendell, who's chair of the Baltimore City Police Department Youth Advisory Board, Rich Morin of the Pew Research Center, who is a report that we have put online, and Elise White, who is Principal Research Associate for the Center for Court Innovation. Coming up on the show tomorrow is Midday TV Talk. The Emmy nominations are out. Midday producer Bridget Armstrong guest hosts, along with WYPR digital producer Jamila Krimpel. They'll size up the year's best and worst small screen performances. And we have to thank Joe Square for providing lunch. They serve pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. That's all for today. I'm Sherry Parks, in for Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. More tomorrow.